Our gospel lesson this morning is from the Gospel of Mark. Listen with me now for God's word for us today. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. Jesus said all this quite openly, and Peter took Jesus aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, Jesus rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." Jesus called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If any of you want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." The word of the Lord. When he picked himself up off the ground, he was in 68th place. That was dead last. He got tripped at the beginning of the 18-mile race. Two other athletes fell on top of him, and one of his ski poles was broken. It was 16 degrees. The wind was whipping. Simon Hegsted Kruger figured the race was over for him. The Norwegian 23-year-old cross-country skier's first Olympics was fast becoming a hard luck story, a story of profound disappointment and loss. But Kruger quickly banished those thoughts from his mind. He got up, his coach handed him a new pole, and Kruger began picking people off one by one. 1 hour and 16 minutes later, he not only finished the race that looked like a lost cause at the beginning, he crossed the finish line for a gold medal with the rest of the field so far behind him they couldn't even see him ahead at some points in the race. It doesn't get any better than this, does it? These are the stories we love to hear, the triumphant individual who overcomes seemingly insurmountable odds only to be victorious and celebrated in the end. But what about those other two athletes, the ones who fell on top of Kruger? We haven't heard much about them. And all the celebration of what he's done, they've gotten lost in the shuffle. One of them actually came in fourth place. But no medal for his Herculean efforts. No celebration, nor no praise. Another one came in 30th, crossing the finish line, I'm sure, with little to no recognition of the mountain he had to climb to finish mid-pack. It's harder for us to know how to feel about the suffering and disadvantage that don't lead to a satisfying victory, to a celebration, to the world's affirmation. What does that kind of suffering mean? And how do we, as people of faith, orient ourselves to the fact that suffering doesn't always end in triumph? Suffering doesn't always make us winners in this world. All the religions and spiritualities of the world want to speak into this difficult truth about suffering. And Christianity has argued with itself about our relationship to suffering and how it connects to the life of faith since our very beginnings. Is it about endurance? Is it about punishment? Is it about resilience? Or is it about redemption? Do we welcome suffering into our lives as a means toward righteousness? Do we avoid suffering in our lives as a means toward happiness? How do we alleviate suffering? And here's the biggest question: how do we connect God to suffering? Now, this argument that Christianity has had with itself is no more intense than in this passage today in the Gospel of Mark, when Jesus explains his relationship to suffering, when Jesus lays bare that he will undergo great suffering, that he will be rejected by the elders, that he will be rejected by the chief priests and the scribes, and that he will be killed, and after 3 days rise again. Well, Peter doesn't like it. So much so that he pulls Jesus, yes, Jesus aside and calls him crazy. The word here for rebuke is the same word that's used for exorcisms and casting out demons. Now, in a culture that was hierarchical like the one Jesus and Peter were living in, a disciple or a student would never take his teacher aside and take any tone of correction, much less tell him he's crazy. Peter's reaction would very well have been seen as arrogant. And often arrogance is born of insecurity. Often arrogance is born of fear. And fear can make us defensive. Fear can make us defiant. But Jesus pushes back on Peter. Get behind me, Satan. You're focusing on the wrong things. You're focusing on your status, on your acceptance, on your comfort. You need to focus on divine things, on truth, on justice, on love, on the lengths to which God will go to heal the world. Take up your cross and follow me, Jesus says. This must have been a shocking, utterly sobering realization for Peter. Following Jesus was going to cost him everything. All the social capital he had built up, all the ways he'd learned to be dutiful and acceptable and respectable, all those things were being turned upside down. Losing was winning, and winning was losing. For Peter, in this moment, the best case scenario for him is that Jesus is crazy. This passage has a lot of unresolved tension, and that is one of our least favorite kinds of suffering, having to sit with conflict, with tension, with things that are not resolved. And this tension sets the stage for the complicated relationship Christians have had with suffering ever since. You see, it's easy to get confused about what Jesus is saying to us here. Pick up your cross. Take up your cross. That has come to be equated with the virtue of resigning ourselves to suffering. Or worse yet, even inviting more suffering in our lives to make us feel like martyrs, like victims who bear our crosses with resignation and obedience. You see, Christians have searched for generations feverishly to look for a way to resolve this tension around why we suffer. And Christians have tried to resolve this tension by trying to find ways to make suffering God's doing or God's desire. But there is nothing in this passage that says God delights in human suffering, or that God thinks suffering is good, or that God is telling us we should suffer without lament. Human life includes suffering. But Jesus doesn't tell us here that our suffering is a means to salvation. He tells us that our relationship to suffering is a window into our relationship to Him. Him, our means to salvation. This Christ-centered relationship to suffering has been a difficult practice for Christians for a long, long time. In the third century, just a few generations after Jesus and Peter faced off on this issue, Origen, who was the first real biblical and theological scholar of Christianity, aspired to follow his father into Christian martyrdom. Origen's father was beheaded during a time when Christians were being persecuted. Origen's relationship to suffering was extreme. He slept on the floor. He owned no shoes. He ate no meat and drank no wine. He even castrated himself at one point, taking some verses in Matthew way too literally. Later in life, Origen was tortured by other Christians because of his stance on theological issues like the nature of the human soul or salvation. He was kept alive only in an effort to try and get him to renounce his faith. When the emperor who had ordered his torture died, and Origen had still not renounced, they let him go free. But by that time, his body was so broken that he died not long after his release. Origen was actually a mystic. He wrote beautiful things about the wonders of God's love. And one of the reasons he was called the heretic of heretics by some was because of his belief in universal salvation. How painful that such a generous soul was so harsh toward his own body. And how tragic that the suffering he endured was multiplied by other believers who wanted to make him suffer more for his belief that God's grace is for all of humanity. Distorted understandings of suffering have continued to stitch their way through the collective Christian psyche. Suffering has been used to condemn, to exclude, to shame, to blame. Christians through the ages have used suffering, the suffering of some, to say, ah, that's a sign of your sin. God brought that on you as punishment. That suffering just shows that you stand outside the bounds of God's grace. These distorted relationships to suffering surely obscure the promise of what Christ invited that crowd to do that day in Mark's gospel, and also to us today, to take up your cross and follow Jesus to a place where suffering is not just vindicated, but where it is healed. Christ's suffering isn't just about a victory in the end. It's about freedom. It's about healing our deepest wounds. When Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me, he's saying, don't pack light on this journey with me. He is asking us to bring our whole selves, bring all your shame, Bring all your suffering, the suffering you bear, the suffering you've caused, the suffering that's made you stronger, the suffering that has left you weary, diminished, not sure if you can go on. Pick it all up. Bring it all with you. Your doubts and your fears, your anger, your despair, bring it with you. Because whatever you deny that you have cannot be healed. It is faith that makes us believe in the worthiness of telling the truth about ourselves, of believing that God can use our suffering to heal us. And that is a categorically different state of being than looking for ways to suffer so that we can endear ourselves to God. God is not a twisted masochist. But God is a tenacious composter. God can take all of our crap and grow things out of it. Do you believe that God can heal you this way? Do you believe that God can free you from the weight of the suffering that you bear, of the suffering that you have caused? Do you believe in the freedom of the cross? A cross that dies and rises by laying bare the sins of the world. We are in a pivotal moment in our country's life. Indeed, in the life of this planet. And there is no shortage of suffering. Suffering is a fact of life. And it so often reveals the ravages of injustice and hate and woundedness. How we as Christians orient ourselves to the suffering of the world is the most pressing challenge before us today as people of faith. Especially for us, for Christians, we believe in a suffering God. Now, our eyes these last several days have been trained toward Parkland, Florida. Another horrific school shooting, a maddening story of multiple interventions and warning signs of an angry young white man armed to the teeth. A wearying reenactment of political denial and manipulation and greed. There is so much tension in this country right now. If you can't feel it, you are in denial. Not only is there unspeakable suffering, but the most sinister thing about human life these days is how many people are profiting from the suffering of others. And so the students of Parkland are rising up. They are calling us out, all of us. The adults, the believers, the alleged justice seekers, those who profess to make the laws, those who say they want our children to be safe. They are taking up their crosses. The weight of their trauma, of their grief, the heaviness of their memories, the shards of their broken dreams. The burdens of their anger and of our collective anger. And they are showing us what it looks like to believe that there has got to be a better way. And they are joining with so many other young people around the country. Black Lives Matter, Take a Knee, Me Too. So many around the world who are saying, please stop hurting us. Please stop making more suffering than there has to be. And if we're taking up our crosses and we are going to follow them on this road to a better way, we can't deny any of the burdens that are ours to carry. The weight of our privilege, the weight of our blind spots, the weight of the comforts that we feel entitled to, The unconscious ways that we see other bodies as more disposable than others. And the ways our comforts come at the expense of the safety of others. The kids in Parkland and in Ferguson and in LA and all over the world, they're holding us accountable for our denial, for our complacency, and brothers and sisters, for our culpability. They are holding up a mirror to us, and it is hard to look at it. That mirror calls us again to examine this age-old question: how have we as Christians positioned ourselves toward the suffering of the world? If you are more tired of the protests than you are of gun violence, take up your cross. If you are more uncomfortable talking about race than you are about racism persisting, take up your cross. If you are more fed up with having to read bad news in the newspaper than you are with poverty and mass deportation and incarceration, take up your cross. If you are more afraid of people finding out the truth about you than you are afraid of living a lie, take up your cross. Because Jesus needs us to bring it all the things that are keeping you and me and us from truly following him and not looking back. Because he's calling us home to a place where we can be at home with ourselves, with each other, with the world, with our Creator, our Redeemer, our Sustainer. I don't know the answer to the question, can we take up our crosses in these pressing times? I know this, losing to win doesn't sound like a very attractive prospect in a world that has taught us that winning means having it all. And yet here you and I are every week claiming that we believe in a God who loves us fiercely enough to believe we are worthy of such a calling. Grace Covenant. Let no one mistake us for people ashamed of Christ's ways in this world. Let them instead look at us and see the courage that really counts when it's time for us to stand up and be healed. Thanks be to God.